Hi,
I'm Ann Ogborn, and this is Hacking the Global Trend, the Global Travel System. I'm with TransRescue. I'm the director, and this talk is going to be about how we move people in danger around the world. David's a young man who his father was Egyptian. Mother is an American. He was whisked off to Egypt as a child and grew up there under very grim circumstances. He's a trans man, and he had absolutely no chance to live his life there, and was in an abusive environment. He contacted us, and we arranged for his escape. He's now 19 and an adult. He started going to the gym. And one day, going to the gym became walking across a big chunk of the Sahara Desert and making his way to contact with one of our agents who got him to the airport. He got on a flight, and he came to us in the Netherlands and to safety. He's doing fine now. His trip was made a hell of a lot easier by the fact that he had an American passport. Not everybody does. We also get people out who have Egyptian passports. And it's much more complicated. So, if you are a Dutch person and you are traveling to a vacation destination, getting a visa for there is probably the least of your problems. At worst, it is a minor bureaucratic nuisance. If you are an Egyptian, it is very difficult indeed. If you are Palestinian or Yemeni, it may be nearly impossible. The global travel system is a very complicated, the global travel system is a tremendously complicated graph search problem. Like any complex system, it contains holes. There is a separate set of rules for every country, because each country makes its own rules about these things. And any such sufficiently complicated system is going to become hackable. I've done a bunch of things in my life. But the last thing I did as a software engineer was to be a logic programmer. I'm a contributor to SWI Prolog. In that role, it was very handy when we started looking at this problem. We have the problem with this large a fan out, if you start looking through all of these visa regulations, all of these flights, you have a very large search space for a solution. So the scary large graph traversal problem. So what we did was we built a large knowledge base that knows all about visas and all about the international travel system. And then we started attacking that problem with a variety of techniques, and that's what the bulk of this talk will be about, is how we made that problem tractable so that we could find these holes. First of all, we gathered a lot of data. If you have an Afghanistan passport, you are going to need a visa in order to perform an airside transit of the Schengen countries. That's what this first line encodes. This is prologue for what it's worth. Well, this is fine, and we're all pretty familiar with this stuff. But what we had to encode was a lot of rules. So if the rule's just static data, here's a list of countries that cannot transit Schengen without a visa, that's fine. But you don't always have a finite list like that. So this is transit without visa prohibited for country and passport. So if you are transiting your own country, you can always do that. If you are considering a country that's in Schengen and you are on an Egyptian passport, no, you cannot transit. This is actually a repeat of the other data. Some indication of the way this works. That's never caused an issue to have that put it in multiple ways. The next line says that the only people who are allowed to transit the United States without a visa are Canadians. And so on. We collect this information from all over the world, digest it. We have a couple of people whose hobby is geography and air travel. They've been awesome. If you're an air travel nerd, talk to me. We encode all of this stuff. Now we have a bunch of rules. Well, if you have a bunch of rules, you can start reasoning. You can start looking through a solution tree of, I will apply this rule, and then I will apply that rule, and then I will apply this rule, and see if I can find a solution. If I don't, I back up. The last time I had a choice about which rule to apply, and I try it again. And anybody who took a prologue section in their computer language class in university will recognize this is prologue. Having knowledge encoded means you can start reasoning and you can build very powerful systems. It's still a very big, very scary system, and if we just did this naively, it wouldn't take us forever to run. So there are things we do to speed it up. First of all, much of this data doesn't change very frequently, and we do scrape. We do grab this data from various APIs, we scrape some, and we, so we have a separate system that keeps track of how quickly this data is likely to go stale. And it only gets the data when it thinks it's stale. Otherwise, it hangs on to it. So, besides that, since we have rules, we know what the rule is. We know fairly easily what things the rule depends on. If we know what it depends on, we can see whether any of those things changed. If none of them has changed, we don't have to figure out that rule again. This is a process that becomes important. So, this process is called tabling. we not only keep data that's become stale, but when we have useful intermediate results, we keep them. Yeah? And that leads to the question, well, should I keep that? Which means there's another, like, expert system, a little, like, old-fashioned symbolic AI system that decides what to keep and what to discard. Things like weird routes around inside the EU. No, we don't keep those. But, oh, that's interesting. That's a way out of Egypt. And that lands you in South America. That's interesting. How people doing? Everybody understanding the talk? Yeah? Okay, we're going to do this. If you're understanding the talk, hold your hand up here. If you're completely confused, hold your hand down here. Hands? Groovy. All right. Okay. So being smart is half the battle. Suppose I have a flight from A to B and a flight from B to C. A thing I can also do with tabling is once I've realized you can get from A to C, I can make a fake flight from A to C. Well, that makes even more stuff to have to consider, right? But believe me, it's far better to do that than it is to have to search a deeper tree. You never want to be searching more plies of a tree than you have to. Anything that shortens the tree, no matter how extreme, helps. So we record our closures. And again, we have an expert system that figures out whether the closures are interesting. For example, we don't record closures that take an absurd amount of flights. At some point, it's just like, there are 9 flights in this route. I just know this ain't going to work. Okay. That still leaves a computationally intensive problem. So the next thing we do is use something called constraints. In Prolog, you start out with variables, and they are not bound. If I say int x in C, we don't know the value that's in x, right? It's garbage. It'll be implementation dependent. If you, in Prolog, having unbound variables is actually useful. This is not just a weird little language quirk, but is an important part of how the language goes. Anybody want to tell me my mother's height? Is it the string hello world? No. Is it -7? No. About 143 centimeters? Maybe. So there's domain. You can constrain things. This is a potential flight path out of Egypt that we're looking at for some conditions. We're going to do Egypt, and then 3 things we haven't figured out yet, and then we're proposing Saudi Arabia as the antidote end location. How's Saudi Arabia for trans rights? Not good. And we would not route somebody into Saudi Arabia as a final destination under normal circumstances. The system, the reason we don't have to run it just once is we do run into lots of weird situations. I have transited people through Iran. But we probably are not interested in a route that ends in Saudi Arabia. So we don't have to look for the rest of this route. We can stop right now and fail. This is a system called constraints. You don't have to figure out my mother's height to know that it's not the string hello world. This is a constraint system. My mother, is my mother more than 8 meters tall? Now, tallest humans like 3 point something meters or, right? I used to have it memorized, 2.83, something like that. The shortest humans like 1 point two something. And my mother must fall somewhere in between these, right? Okay. My father was 180 centimeters high. My mother's shorter than my father. Fine, we now have reduced the bounds. My mother can be no taller than 180 centimeters and no shorter than whatever we decide the minimum is, right? If I then start giving you other facts, pretty soon we end up with a pretty narrow range. Nice part is we are eliminating large parts of the search tree by doing this. So this these constraint systems really cause a speed up because they cut out parts of the search tree, and cutting out parts of the search tree is where it's all about. So often constraints overlap. We often will find that a rote won't work for a number of reasons. And if it's not going to work for a number of reasons, we not only want to fail fast, but we want to rapidly fail fast. That means reducing the number of constraints. So as there get to be more constraints dangling off of a variable, there's a system by Tom Frewerth, who's an academic, called constraint handling rules, which works to reduce constraints to overlying constraints. Yeah? If we already know my mother is under 180 centimeters, we don't have to worry about the rule that my mother's under 8 meters high. So by the time we apply all of this stuff, we end up with a fairly tractable problem, although sometimes I go get lunch while it runs. But we maintain this little system called DataScoop, and we use it to get people out of very dangerous places. And I'm actually running quite a bit short. So that's how we get people out. We find weird little holes that... and I'm not going to tell you what the holes are, because every time we tell somebody about a hole, it gets closed pretty quickly. We get to use a hole about 3 times, and then it's gone. So since I gave a talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about TransRescue. Forgive me. Our work's deadly serious. We've saved 160 lives, and we've never lost a passenger in transit, but we've had passengers murdered immediately after they got to their destination, and we've had passengers murdered while waiting for us to get to them. And our work is expensive. If you run a normal nonprofit, you just have like an office expense and so on. We have almost none of that because we're all volunteers, with the exception of our attorney, who is Kenyan, and we pay the princely sum of $400 a month. The rest of us are all volunteers. I am a 60-hour a week volunteer for Trans Rescue. Most of our donations go to airline tickets and cheap hotel rooms. We often have to hold people in seedy rooms for a long time for months or so while we process paperwork. If you have a mind to, this is our donation link, and we would appreciate your support. We also have that link at our, we're out there with the little trains talking to people. We have another thing we're doing. The United States is becoming dangerous for trans people. It's showing scary resemblance to the 1930s in Germany. I think we're the Jews this time. So we are working to get Americans out. Obviously, we are not going to buy every one of 1.6 million trans Americans a plane ticket. But the fact is that most trans Americans are out. The government has figured out that it can identify us by looking at whether or not we had a passport and a different gender. I personally am in on this. I'm an American. And in April of 2027, I become a person without a passport because I cannot renew my passport. So we're going to have a lot of Americans showing up in Europe, folks. And please, if you can, help them out. A lot of them are part of our hacker community. There's a huge overlap. I suggest you walk around here and you will rapidly see the large number of trans women in our midst. There is a large overlap, and folks are going to need your help. And you're going to see a lot of trans people showing up. It's already started. Our house is getting full. So if you have a sofa, this is a good use for it. Okay, that's my talk. And I'm up for discussion and taking questions. I may end up having to sit down at some point. I'm elderly and kind of disabled and have rheumatism and may have to sit down in the chair. It's only because of my body. I'm open for questions. Questions? We got a microphone. Please do use the mic.
Contact you, your organization, when they are in danger and want to go away.
We're on most social media, and people in places like this actually do have social media groups, and particularly sometimes live online because it's not safe in the real world. And it's not at all, it's an interesting phenomena. The internet can be a safe haven for a lot of people around the world. I worked for Pogo. And people know Pogo, now Electronic Arts Family Games. I was an engineer for them. I wrote Puppet. But I did their internationalization. And I rapidly found out as I started working on the problem that being accessible was just as important because, gosh, who's got time to sit around and spend lots of hours playing fairly simple games online back in the early 90s? Well, it turns out a lot of disabled people. So These online communities can become important resources, and we all know communities like this. And certainly it's not safe to be trans many places in the world. But I'm well known on Arabic Twitter, Arabic trans Twitter. We maintain pretty much normal social media presence, and people email us or contact us through Telegram or Signal. We publish our Signal number, but we ask like people to only contact us that way from places that have state actor threats, Afghanistan, Saudi, Eritrea, those kinds of places.
Hello. Do you have any success story where you said, the algorithm give you a route, it was okay, but then it just worked?
Yeah. Actually, for a while, yes, we have a method that became one of our standard methods. And sometimes it's like so obvious that we don't have to use this thing. But yes, we have a method called the reverse cowboy. And Datascoop found the reverse cowboy, suggested it to us for a passenger. We said, ooh, that's a neat trick. So, and none of us had thought of it. Essentially, it involves just sending the person to some place they can get to, and then doing all your skullduggery on the way home.
Turn a flight, let's say, in the...
Yeah, because nobody looks at return flights. we have a lot of crazy tricks like that. More questions? More questions. We may be really short if there's no more questions. Oh, come on. No more questions? There's a question in the back. Can we get the microphone back to the back?
Do you ever use the short hop methods where it's like for a long flight, but the plane has to refuel in a country?
Yeah.
Where they then get off and then it's like, well, I'll just get up here and then
yes, we use that all the time.
Somewhere else. That's
yep. Yeah. We also we do a lot of changing planes. Weirdly, we will buy the shittiest tickets imaginable. Believe me, if you ever travel with us, it is going to be the worst trip of your life.
Because, so Spirit Airlines.
The average trans rescue like airline ticket contains a 15-hour layover in someplace miserable, and six hops. More questions. You have a question? No. Okay. Anybody else? Nope. Hang on.
How long does it take to run in average? A couple of hours, a couple of days, a couple of...
To get somebody out? Quite often, we have to get somebody out of a very dangerous place. Quite often, they don't have much freedom in their life. So we get them someplace that we can get them without them having to apply for paperwork. They then have to stay there while we apply for paperwork. So we have people in crappy hotels in all over the developing world at the moment. And eventually we straighten out the paperwork and then we fly them somewhere. The record for the longest one, once we started moving somebody, was 4.5 months. The shortest time it ever took us to get anybody out was 2 days. We got a Russian trans guy out. He contacted me at 10 a.m. my time, and by 9:30 p.m. my time, he was out of the country because we were very afraid he would be drafted. Commentary on how transphobia really works. Russia under Putin is terribly transphobic, but there is one gleaming affirmation of trans people's identity. Trans men can be drafted in Russia. Huh? Unexpected ally. Thanks, Mr. Putin. Yeah. More questions? More questions. It's okay. All right. Hey, short talk. All right. Thanks.